Well, I see, Lionel, you're holding a great Panini stickers album of the Tour de France 2020. Do you know who wrote the fascinating literature you've got in there?
It was you, was it?
It was me.
When you say literature.
Well, that's I think that's about 252 words of literature in there. And the first time, I did it for the first time last year. I actually did all of them because there's only been two Panini albums.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast. Powered by Zwift, the fitness app where fun is fast.
Yeah, I feel like a kid again. Never let it be said I'm not a serious journalist. I'm Lionel Burney, age 45 and a quarter. I'm going to collect my Panini sticker album, Rich. Remember during the Giro, I didn't complete it, did I? Because I couldn't find the stickers anywhere. But I gather it will be easier to find them here in France.
Yeah, the first sticker you pulled out of your when you opened your Giro one was none other than our diarist, Lucas Postelberger, who'd just won the stage and taken the pink jersey.
If I'd opened the stickers before the stage and Postelberger had come out first, as he did, and then he'd won the stage, I would have thought there was some kind of mystic quality to the stickers. So I'm going to try it again. We're talking a few hours before the start of stage one. Richard?
I heard the Chris Froome sticker is the most in demand, you know, but there you are.
Oh, I've got some cracking stickers here, Rich. I've got the first of our diarists is Nikias Arndt. He'll be going in the sticker album. Potential winners today, Giacomo Nizzolo, Alexander Kristoff. Who else? Sam Bennett. It's written in the stickers.
Wawa, you've got Wawa there.
Barguil, Danny Martinez, Mikel Nieve. I've got Rigoberto Urán, Andre Greipel, another potential top 10 today. Let's not get carried away. Fading force, isn't he, these days?
Well, he's been a fading force for the best part of a decade, literally.
So I'm going to stick these stickers in my album and I'm off and running. It's all in the swapsies, isn't it? That's where the business models are genius. I'd love to know, I'm sure this is a closely guarded secret, but do they print equal numbers of every sticker? Or do they manufacture the market? Do they rig the market so that there's an absolute glut of Alessandro De Marchis?
Well, we'll have to ask our man in the know, our mole in Panini Towers, about that. And who are you going to swap them with is the other question.
That's a very good point. I did promise Moyin Islam, who sent me the sticker album, because I couldn't find one in the shops, I promised to keep any swapsies for his children. So that's probably where they'll go. I'll post them to Moyin. I'll disinfect them first and post them to him.
Yeah. Lionel, I think you're going to ride the Col d'Aise, are you not? A mythical local climb.
I am, Rich, yeah. I've got my Ireland jersey. As you know, Ireland dominated the Col d'Aise in the 80s. Stephen Roach and Sean Kelly won every year between 1981 and 1989. I think the final score ended Sean Kelly 5, Stephen Roach 4. Well, there's going to be one Lionel Burney up there in an Ireland cycling jersey a bit later on.
We'll follow you on Strava and see if you manage to be the third fastest Irishman on the Col d'Aise.
Do you not think that when the race goes over there this weekend, Sam Bennett might possibly beat my time?
He might, yeah, really.
I mean, he's no climber, but yes.
He's actually a pretty good climber, actually. For a sprinter, he's probably the best climber of the sprinters.
He's a better climber than you.
That goes without saying.
Mais voici Sean Kelly, l'Irlandais. Il ne porte plus le maillot de leader, mais un maillot rose du classement par points. Il a perdu sa première place hier soir à Mandelieu.
Hi Sean, how are you doing?
Yes, good now.
Yeah, I wanted to pick your brains. I'm going to be riding the Col d'Aise, and I thought you'd be the man to ask for a few tips.
Yes, are you riding in a race or in a time trial?
Neither. I'm touring.
Okay, so what would we call that? Leisure ride, Col d'Aise.
Yeah, well, tell me how you tackled it.
The only way that I was allowed to tackle it was full gas. Because it was always in a time trial, of course. Yeah, you do a warm-up ride, but most of the time, like I just remember full on, and every time I sat in the saddle for more than 200 metres or maybe 250 metres, I was getting the call, "Debout, stand up."
Who was that from?
Well, it was from Drigabaldi or from the mechanic or from Christian Rimaud, who was the sports director. You know, there was probably three of them at least in the car. So, you know, one would give a big shout, full on, roaring at me. And then the other one, when I sit down for that 200 metres, then I get the shout from the other one.
Was 1982 the first time you rode it, or had you raced up it before?
Well, I suppose it was just before the event fear, and probably in the hour leading up to it, probably went for a shift four or five times. because, you know, you were there to start at the bottom of the Col d'Aix, and, you know, that area there, in that time you had only a small van. And I remember he had the masseur Pinatelli. He used to always get a place in the back of the cafe where he put the rollers in. And, you know, I would do the normal warm-up, ride the bike a bit, because you'd be after doing a stage that morning. Of course, it was totally different than it has been in recent years, or in most recent years. You know, they just had the time trial only. So we always had that 100-kilometre stage in the morning, quite difficult. And so, yeah, the warm-up on the road wasn't a lot, but you would do the rollers in the back of the cafe there, and there would be guys in and out of the to the toilet, you know, the French guys smoking fags and blowing fucking smoke in your face, and you'd be on the rollers there, you know, and he would be saying, yeah, you know, there's 15 minutes at the start now. And so, yeah, you just do that and you get off the rollers maybe 10 or 12 minutes before your start time, and, you know, just dry off, he would dry off there, you know, with a towel, and then you'd pull up your time trial suit, if you had one, or if it wasn't, you'd just put on that jersey they gave you in the earlier days.
So it was the nerves played havoc in the last half hour, did it?
Yeah, well, the build-up, because, you know, you're so close to the start area there, and, you know, you can hear the speaker there, you know, saying, you know, this rider going off and that rider going off. So, you know, the rider is getting, you know, when it's getting close to, you know, half an hour before your start time, 20 minutes before your start time. So you're there and all that build up. So that, yeah, builds the nerves. And of course, yeah, I remember my first year, it was difficult because, you know, I didn't know against Duco LaSalle. Yeah, it was the first time I was in a situation ever in, you know, in my bike racing career, my up to that time. So it was pretty stressful times, you know, so nervous there, and as I said.
I've wiggled my way out of the centre of Nice to the foot of the Col d'Aix. Took me a little while because obviously the roads are closed for La Course this morning and the Tour de France Stage 1 this afternoon. Feels very eerie, surreal almost, compared to a normal opening weekend of the Tour de France. It's very, very quiet indeed, almost the ghost Grand Départ, for understandable reasons, of course. So I'm at the foot of the Col d'Aix, and they put a sign up that says Route du Tour de France, and the riders will be tackling this on Stage 2, famous for the conclusion of Paris-Nice. It used to be the time trial stage that would finish the race to the sun, and as I've said, it's Irish mountain, really. The graphic tells me that it's 10 kilometres from here to the top. It's 507 metres of altitude at the top. The average gradient is 4.9% and the maximum gradient is 10%. And where I'm standing now is just off the main road where the Col d'Aix starts. And just behind these apartment blocks, there'll be the bars and cafes where back in the day the riders would have warmed up for the time trial, having done a morning stage in Paris-Nice on the final day. The time trial was where the race was so often decided by, sometimes just by a matter of seconds. And well, we think that warming up on the rollers or the turbo trainer is a relatively modern phenomenon, but no, they were doing it in the 80s as well, as Sean Kelly explained. So I haven't really had much of a warm-up. I've been stopped by the traffic lights and I've had to kind of scoot past the road closures, so I'm not exactly pinging at the moment. So the opening few hundred metres of this climb that might sting the legs a bit. I'm just getting my excuses in early, just in case Richard demolishes my time later on.
If you can come off the ramp, just, you know, ready, 100%, everything perfect, and just go full on from, you know, from the moment you just roll down there, and then you had that maybe 150 metres, you turn left, you're onto the onto Col d'Aise, and it was just, you know, full on all the time. And yeah, the team, you know, the team never gave you a moment where, you know, you could maybe sit in the saddle for too long, as they say. And that was the plan, you know. The moment we shout at you, you have to get out of the saddle and, you know, relancer, you know, just get it going again. When you sit in the saddle, you lose a bit of your speed, and, you know, they just keep on to you all the time, and that's what it is for that 20-odd minutes.
Is it a stupid thing to say that it hurts? Does it go without saying that an effort like that hurts?
Yeah, it's fucking, you know, it is torture, you know. You just go so deep, and if you're good, and then you can go that bit deeper, and, you know, you just push that pain barrier so much on an effort like that. It is horrible, and, you know, everything is hurting on the cold days. Like, your heart is pumping out of your chest. You know, the lactic, you can feel it in your legs. Your back is killing you, because a cold day is, you know, it's not a steep climb, so you have to use metla brache, you know, put the gears, you know, meaning push a heavy gear, and you have to be able to use a pretty heavy gear up there. The back also kills you there on the climb, so everything hurts.
So with about 4 kilometres to go to the summit, you reach the Quatre Chemins, the four ways, or the four routes junction, and the roads go off in all different ways, up to the top and over the Col d'Aise and onto La Turbie, or down into Villefranche, or back down into Nice, a couple of different ways. And it really kind of kicks up here. This next bit that I can see is the steepest gradient that I've ridden so far. And well, let's hope it doesn't go on too long, that steep bit.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift, the fitness app that turns indoor riding into a game. Explore endless roads, race riders from all over the world, and boost your fitness with monthly training plans and structured workouts. Join the world's training playground, where fun is fast. Go to Zwift.com and start your free trial.
I'm Ashley Moman-Pessio from the CCC Live team. I'm very fortunate from the very beginning. I've had a great setup to do Zwift. So, I have a great tech smart trainer and a big screen TV, you know, and I thought, okay, well, I'm gonna give it a try. So I sort of got onto Zwift and started exploring Watopia, and then got the odd invite from the Italian pros to join these meetups. And that was really a turning point for me, you know. So joining the meetups on Zwift is really what kind of made me realize, you know, the potential of the platform, that your training can still be fun, even though you're stuck indoors, you know. So being able to start in New York on a New York course with pros from Italy and other parts of the world, you know, it was like, wow, this is quite amazing, you know, how the world just kind of opens up, you know, quite ironically in this lockdown phase. On the road, we find ways of kind of cheating a little bit, or making things easier for ourselves in terms of, you know, a higher cadence or throwing the bike. On an indoor trainer, there's no cheating, you know, power is power, and, you know, you have to push to get the numbers. And I suppose the other thing that really changed is I started to really, realize the opportunities within Zwift. So You know, the social aspect of it was really great for the longer rides. You know, I'd break them up into a morning and an afternoon session at sometimes like a couple of meetups in a day, you know, so suddenly my riding was becoming more social than it had ever been. And then I started to like realize things, you know, for example, Alpe d'Huzwift, you know, suddenly I realized, well, okay, Alpe d'Huzwift makes my interval training that much easier because I can simulate what I'm usually doing outside. And I also realized through this whole process that I was working on a weakness. So as a climber, you know, I'm very much a high cadence rider, using the bike to produce the numbers. But I suppose my weakness is that sort of raw power. So being on the indoor trainer was helping me to work on that weakness, which was, you know, to produce more raw power.
Would a big ring climb in those days, or not quite?
No, not quite. In the earlier parts, you know, I remember starting off the ramp, you stay on the small ring, you'd have it lower down in the sprocket, you know, pretty much down to the lower, the second last one or the third last one from the bottom, and then you just make that effort into the left hand that would go onto the edge, and then you'd knock it up the brackets a bit as you go. And you'd climb a bit there, you know, the first 2K, and then you would go on to the big ring. And the big ring, of course, you would have changed. You'd put a smaller big ring, meaning a 50 or a 50, maybe one or something like that. I think it's about a 50 we used to use. And you go on to that for, you know, quite a while then, because it does ease off and it goes downhill a bit. And then it starts to kick up again. And there, normally, you would, you know, go down on the inside ring as well. And the inside ring, you'd have probably a 40... I think it's about a 44 I used to put on.
And I mean, you say it's not a crazy steep climb, is it? It's actually quite gentle. If you did it in a road race, it would be maybe a third category climb, something like that, wouldn't it?
Yes.
But because it's a time trial, it's kind of almost a perfect test of not just physical strength, but also kind of the pedaling ability as well, I guess. It's almost the sort of 400 metres of cycling, in a way. That lung-busting effort it's all about the pacing.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't really say it's a tester's time trial because, you know, the real testers, they're probably, you know, the real flat stuff and, you know, the real time trialers. You know, look at my time. You look at, you know, Van den Broek, he was really super in prologues. He was a great time trialist, but on cold days, he always suffered a bit because, you know, the climb he didn't like, you know, he wasn't able to get up the hill very well. So, you know, it's more of a power man's climb, really. That's, you know, even a good sort of a classics rider, you know, he could ride cold days because, you know, it's a power man's climb and, that's what it's all about, and it's just, you know, so close, so, you know, so tight in the end, and depending on who you're up against as well, because, you know, I did beat Duke Lucatel very well in that time trial, but I didn't know that going into it, so yeah, it was really nervous times and getting it perfectly right, and I suppose, yeah, the team as well, you know. Steve Ubaldi, he was in that position, I suppose, of rider before, so he was the one who was guiding me, and he had sort of, yeah, decided what we do, you know, from the finish of the morning stage on the Promenade d'Anglais, for example, you know, just, you know, go to your room after the stage, have a bit of food X number of hours before, and then just rest up, and yeah, we'll get you down, give you a bike, and you roll out to the start.
So really, it was the perfect climb for you. It suited everything you had.
Yes, it did. Well, you know, when you look at my results there, you know, I won a number of times. I beat a Roach. You know, other times I was very close to a Roach. You know, I was only sitting a couple of seconds in it. So yeah, it was a time. It was a climb and a time trial that suited me.
So advice for me then, really, just I need somebody to shout at me all the way up.
Yes, that's right. Somebody with a loudspeaker out of the roof of the car, and, you know, don't try and go too explosive because it might explode yourself.
So what would they shout?
Well, are you talking English or French? Or?
Well, in French, what would they shout at you? What would Jean and the mechanic and Remo shout?
Well, they just say, a block, a block. And then they would say, when you sit down for a while, debout, which means, you know, stand up. That turns over the saddle.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. So they will be the two most popular ones that, you know, and, you know, they'd say, okay, c'est bien, that'll be another one which will come out quite a lot when they be roaring at you.
Nice one. Well, yeah. I'll remember that as I'm riding up. I'm going to ride up in my Ireland jersey, you know, to make it 10
okay.
Irish wins.
Yes. Well, as we give you an Irish passport, you have to do that. A bloc, a bloc. C'est bien.
Well, there we are, the Col d'Aise. A lovely climb, really. Exactly my kind of climb, because the last 1,500 metres are downhill and flat. It's a sort of suburban climb. It just gets you out of the chaos of Nice. But you don't feel too detached from the town. The villas get slightly plusher as you come up the climb. And it does feel like you've made a long journey from the hustle and bustle of the city. At the summit here, there's a big sculpture of a bicycle made from metal and wood, and well, it's unmistakably Mediterranean, really. The grey sun-baked road and the rocky greenery, and every now and again you get a glimpse of the Med below. The Côte d'Azur has got a slightly greyish tinge to it today because the clouds overhead are a little bit black, but a very pleasant climb. And now I'm going to descend back down the way I came up, I think, because if I go over that way, I'd get to La Turbie, and then you can take a turn and drop down into Monaco and visit Monte Carlo, where the yachts are on another level to the ones I've glimpsed in the sea below me on the way up. I don't think I'll be troubling the Strava leaderboard with my climb today, and I don't think Richard will have too much trouble beating me either. But neither of us are going to get close to the man who holds the record for the Paris-Nice time trial on Col d'Aise, and that's Bradley Wiggins, who won the race in 2012, the start of the year that led to his victory in the Tour de France, of course. And just before the Tour, it occurred to me that we'd be driving down to the far southwest corner of France, just as we did in 2009 when the race started in Monaco. And Bradley Wiggins made his big breakthrough as a Grand Tour rider, finishing fourth in that year's Tour after a solid Giro d'Italia where he showed signs of what was to come. I spoke to Bradley just before the Tour began. He'll be part of the Eurosport and GCN team covering the Tour de France, of course. But first of all, I wanted to ask him about his memories of 2009.
I just remember being really relaxed, and I think that was the nature of the team I was in at the time, that it was just such a laid-back, great, fun atmosphere to be in Garmin. And, you know, I was surrounded by people like David Miller and Christian Vandeveld, who were very encouraging. And I remember I was there in the role of looking after Christian Vandeveld, really, who there was uncertainty about him because he'd crashed in the Giro and finished fifth the year before. So, you know, he was still the team leader, and I was probably convincing myself he was the team leader more to take the pressure off. But, you know, I envisaged riding in his company and certainly able of a top 20, but, you know, an outside bet of a top 10. And I think I said to Will Fotheringham that I reckon I could do that. You know, and I didn't say things like that then if I didn't believe it. It was only 3 years before that. I was, or 2 years before that, I was being followed around in a camping car by you guys, hoping I'd finish the race.
Yeah.
So I really believed that. And I had a sort of an air of confidence about me. And I guess that was amplified and borne out the fact there was this sense of shallowly, you know, that I know something you guys don't know, not you personally, but just the world, you know, and that I was felt like I was going to shock the world in some way, but didn't want to shout too loudly. And I think that was came straight away in the prologue. I think it's third in the prologue there. And from that moment on, I didn't step out of the top five or six in the tour that whole race. But the first few days, I remember thinking if I could stay close enough, I could get the yellow jersey here. Because we had a team time trial on day four, I think it was, and we had a strong squad. And but we missed that little split in the crosswind, whatever day it was. Day three, I think it was the day before the team time trial. So that put paid to chances to that. So, I mean, that was it, really. I just remember being supremely confident. And I think that confidence stemmed from I had nothing to lose. I'd never even been in a position before where I could remotely get something like that. But no one really knew because I was riding for Christian van der Velde. And also, if it didn't happen, then I wasn't going to, no one would have noticed what I was really feeling inside. So that all added to that wave of confidence, really. And there was no pressure on me. So it was actually a really nice position to be in.
Yeah, I remember there was a story about you going over the top of one of the first big mountains in the lead group and kind of, I don't know whether this was true or whether it was something that we picked up from other riders. He kind of punched the air and shouted something like, "That's what I'm talking about." Is that, you know, was that as much proving something to yourself as well as everybody watching?
I think so, yeah. But that just shows how precarious I was as an athlete, really. That it was all that sort of feeling that it was kind of, I was on my own and I was always... And I guess that was probably against the journalists, really, tragically, when I look back. It was that's how I got my motivation, my kicks, really, was feeling that I would somehow... And, you know, you spent a lot of time around me back then. It was, you know, I'd go from not talking to people one year to being really friendly the next, you know, and that's kind of what I was like. And, you know, that's just as I was, you know. It was could be quite childish and petulant, but then I could be lovely, you know, and I think that was, that's just me assessing how I used to be as a rider, really. And in fact, I can admit that now, it's fine, because imagine if I was still like that at 40, I'd be quite sad, really. But there wasn't, on that story, there was another thing that, even as now still doing the rounds, there's a story, because Teo asked me a while ago, that me and Andy Schleck were going over a mountain pass once, almost mocking... In that tour, actually, mocking Cadell. Mm. And I was spouting. We were going up this climb hard. There was about 20 of us left. And I started... I was so comfortable that I started reciting lines from the movie Snatch about Nemesis. Do you know what Nemesis means? And I did the whole monologue of that film. And Andy Schleck was next to me. And he's relayed that, although he probably doesn't know the whole monologue. But I did Bricktop's monologue of, you know, do you know what Nemesis means?
Righteous infliction of retribution manifested by an appropriate agent. Personified in this case by a horrible me.
And I did that whole thing behind Cadell. Stupid. I mean, I don't know why. If someone had heard me, they probably had me sectioned, really, because I was probably not quite right in the head. But that happened, and Teo asked me, so it's still doing the rounds.
And then, of course, well, Evans then won the tour in your year when it didn't all work out for you the following year. I was going to just say that, do you think cycling is one of those sports, when you look back to 2009, you can't do it until you've shown you can do it. No one believes you can do it until you've shown you can do it. And so the scepticism kind of follows everyone until they deliver with the results, I guess.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. So, I mean, well, it was 2009, then 3 years later, I won the race. But you sort of look what happened in that 3 years, you know, the year after I I just sort of fell to pieces, really, mentally. Although I finished 21st, I think it was. A year later, I won the Dauphiné and was in a position to maybe get on the podium again or win it. Crashed out. And then the year after that, I won it. And then I went back to the Giro the following year, 13, and was back to that 2010 self again. So, yeah, what a roller coaster. I was never very consistent on that stage as an athlete. Yet every Olympiad, I was the cool kind of calm and collected Olympic athlete that won everyone. So,
yeah, you know, your career is almost like the profile of a mountain stage, isn't it? With the peaks,
very
and
much
the troughs.
So, yeah. Very much on the road it was, whereas that track Olympic thing. But I guess that was probably informed too much by me creating battles with the media in my head.
Just starting on 2012 a little bit, because again, it strikes me another one of those key moments was when you won the time trial on Col d'Ez, which, as we all know from watching cycling in the 80s, was kind of like the Irish Hill, wasn't it? Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach. But
yeah,
you turned that into a time trial rather than a climb almost that day. And I mean, it was dead close against Louis Westra, wasn't it? But it was that was the kind of the first of the building blocks that led up to that 2012 tour, it strikes me, looking back.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I have no memories of that day, really, other than, I don't know, really, other than I was racing my power meter that day. I can't remember much about the race, really, that day. I have no vivid memories of that time trial or anything, really.
19, c'est pas fait encore, 12 secondes, ça devrait suffire. 19-10, il va peut-être qu'il réalise le meilleur temps, il a gagné Paris-Nice. Bravo, en grand champion, Bradley Wiggins remporte Paris-Nice, il a fini.
They'll be going over the Col d'Ez on the second stage. It's a different proposition when it's a road race, so I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I do remember that 2009 tour, that opening road stage, being very nervous and sort of, I think we descended Col d'Ez potentially that stage, and we definitely went over the big climb over the back of Nice. The first stage of a Tour de France that's a road stage is always very nervous and is very different to a prologue. You know, there's that build up in the days before.
Just lastly for me, about what do you make of the course itself? Because I mean, when you compare it back to 2009, I mean, it's like chalk and cheese, really, isn't it? I mean, it seems to be a lot of traps look like they've been set on some of these, particularly the first week. There's opportunities, but it could also backfire if things get, you know, explosive early on in stages. You know, it could be a lot of to and fro, chasing and being in the wrong position. It's not straightforward, it doesn't look.
No, and it's the tour seems to be getting more and more like that every year, doesn't it? I mean, you've got one time trial now, which is a mountain time trial as well, second last day, no team time trial this year. I spoke to Cav the other week about whether he was riding or not before he's announced, and he said there's potentially four sprint stages. I mean, the pattern of the race now has completely changed. I mean, four potential sprint stages is, I mean, when I was a kid watching it, we used to love watching the first week. You'd have seven or eight sprint stages before the mountains and watching Cipollini and Abdujaparov and Blaylevens and all these guys going head-to-head. And that was bloody exciting to watch. You know, now there's no chance for the sprinters per se, you know, and that's a shame because, you know, we love watching those stages. And I just think the whole pattern of the race, and you'd have to ask, you know, why is it like that? I mean, what kind of race are they trying to create, really, for the viewing public? So it's, you know, I've never really got my head around that one. We just sort of go along with it every year, really, and never ask too many questions. But, you know, what is the pattern of a Tour de France? You know, maybe there was too much pattern to a Tour de France. And the reason lots of people like watching the Giro and the Vuelta is because it's unpredictable and different things are being thrown in all the time. So maybe the Tour wants to be a bit more unpredictable, and maybe the Tour don't want it as predictable as people, and people like to think it is, you know. And we always say, or I always say, that there's more of a pattern to the race in the Tour, and trying to get away from that kind of cliche.
I think they'd be quite happy if it came down to the time trial at the very end, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and you know, as a spectator here now, you know, I can't wait for that. So, you know, maybe that is a good thing.
Well, people can catch you, your analysis on Eurosport, and also in the Bradley Wiggins podcast. I mean, obviously, everyone will listen to that after they've listened to us, but, you know.
Well, no, it's the number one podcast now, isn't it?
Well, I think if we can get on the podium, we'll be happy this year. If you're ever down in this corner of France and you want to ride the Col d'Aise, then you're looking for the Boulevard Bischofsheim, which is the bottom of the climb, and then that becomes the Boulevard de l'Observatoire, and then you're looking for the Avenue de la Condamine, which is the road that takes you up to the summit of the Col d'Aise. There's so much great riding around here, of course. You could do the Col de Turini, which the Tour de France is also doing, or the famous Madone climb, which is within striking distance of here. Or you could take the train into Italy and ride at the finale of Milan-San Remo, the traditional route over the Cipressa, the Capi and the Poggio.
Well, Lionel, were you the fastest Irishman up the Col d'Aise this weekend?
I think you know the answer to that, Richard. I wasn't. I may well have been the fastest Irishman up Col d'Aise between the hours of 10:30 and 11:30 on Saturday morning, possibly.
I think we have to narrow it down to minutes rather than hours.
Yeah, there's always a chance another Irish person was riding the climb yesterday. But, Nico Roach, son of Stephen Roach, of course, went over the top of the Col d'Aise at the head of the peloton. The bunch was all back together at that point. And I thought that was quite fitting, really. There was some Roach graffiti on the road around about a kilometre, maybe a kilometre and a half from the top yesterday that I noticed, and maybe that was a little bit of motivation he needed. I'm going to have to ask Sean Kelly whether he considers that Roach drawing equalizer. Level 5. Yeah, is that the equaliser? I don't think it is really, but it was nice to see an Irishman go over the top first, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I tried to ride up the Col d'Aise yesterday. I didn't. I went a different way up the Col d'Aise, let's just say. An alternative Col d'Aise. Because I've never ridden around here, actually. A lot of pros live here. I've been down here to interview professional riders. And they always talk about how good the roads are around here. But before you get to the really good roads, you've got to battle a bit of traffic and some quite complicated roads. We went out this morning, didn't we, Lionel? We did quite a hilly ride up to Saint-Paul-de-Vence, a beautiful hilltop village, old village where I've been on holiday, and it's absolutely lovely. Went on from there to Vence and then back down to join the coast. I must say, I haven't been cycling with you for a while, very impressed by your descending. You're a very good descender, Lionel. You drop like
here we go.
You drop like a couple of bags of cement.
I also climbed like a couple of bags of cement today. I was really suffering. I mean, you were going well, I have to say. We were out with our colleague Tom Carey from The Telegraph. He's not ridden a bike for quite a long time. And, I was worried that you were going to take us over the Col d'Aise proper, because that is a serious climb. From the coast up to the very top, it's sort of 16, 17 kilometres of... and with some quite steep sections, and I was nervous that you were double bluffing me, and we'd have to climb the Col d'Aise. So I was easing back a little bit, but we turned just before the road started to quieten down a bit, and we dropped back down towards Cagnes-sur-Mer, and then came back into Nice. It was a nice ride, but my legs feel a little bit spongy this evening. But we'll see how we go. Tomorrow. The other highlight of the day was. Getting bought some Panini stickers for my album, Rich. Another 6 packets. It was like being a child all over again and getting a little present of Panini stickers. Some absolute belters came out this afternoon. Who do we have? We had Julian Alaphilippe, who won the stage and took the yellow jersey today. So there we are.
So apparently the worthless stickers are non-speechers, because you had 3 or 4 of them in your packets. Or, you know, we actually discussed the possibility that, you know, because there's lots of conspiracy theories about Panini stickers, but maybe the Nice area, that's the area in which, you know, you always get a non-speechers sticker, whichever, you know, packet you buy. So,
well, the beauty of this is we're going to be travelling around France, so if there is some kind of geo-restriction on the distribution of Panini stickers, I hope to have a decent chance to complete the album.
there's a glut of Nance Peters stickers in the Nice area. It's like a red zone for Nance Peters.
Well, that's actually the best piece of information we've given since the start of the tour, and maybe it's the best piece of information you'll get, guys, until the end of the tour, you know, so beware of Nance Peters stickers.
Well, we're on the road tomorrow. We'll be getting into the car and heading to Sisteron.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort, and your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.